This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana. Signature support from the Mayor's Office of East Baton Rouge Parish, and our show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from Caroline Romer, the Executive Director of the Louisiana Public Charter School Association. But right now in studio is John Rapolo, who's an investigative reporter for Fox 44 and Channel 33, the NBC affiliate in our community. And he is a veteran reporter who arrived here a few months ago from Boston, studied at Emerson College, and has worked in many places in the country, most recently in Corpus Christi, right?
Most recently, Jim, in Pensacola.
You also worked in Texas as well, didn't you?
I have really strong roots, journalism roots, in the great state of Texas. Enjoyed it there very much.
So you've gotten accustomed to the South, and now you're in a place where politics is supreme, as Caroline Romer can attest, and there's a lot of politics going on, as tonight there may be a new superintendent of schools selected in East Baton Rouge Parish. The finalists are Kevin George, a local guy at the Lab School, and Andrea Zayas, who has great credentials but has worked in other places. But there's all kinds of maneuvering behind the scenes. What's going on?
Well, obviously the second largest school district in the state, Jim, as you know, any time that I have covered a superintendent search throughout the years, there has been a tremendous amount of public input, depending on, I think, you know, what's happening internally and in the community. I think here, obviously a little bit of background. June 28th, the vote was 5-4 to pick three finalists, Kevin George, Andrea Zayas, and of course, Krish Mohip, who dropped out early Saturday morning. I got a text message early saying that he had dropped out. So there was two finalists. On Monday, they began the interview process of interviewing with the community, with teachers, and then it's all leading to today.
All right. So what's going to happen today? Are we going to have a new superintendent?
Well, that depends on who you talk to. Now, I did a report last night. We talked to, the gentleman that you had on the air, yesterday, a former school board president, Mr. Lannis, correct. Thank you. And, you know, there's a lot of scenarios going on. I also talked to the school board president, Carla Powell Lewis, last week. Bottom line is they want to appoint Mr. Smith, Adam Smith, to that position.
Who is not one of the finalists.
He's not one of the finalists. And that has erupted can we say organized chaos in the community?
Yeah, sick outs and all this talked about.
Well, three unions are saying that they're going to threaten a strike or a sick out, however you want to call it, if Smith is not appointed. So tonight, there's a couple of options, at least that's what I'm being told and what I've been reporting, is that one of the board members can request a motion that has to be seconded to appoint Mr. Smith. And depending on the vote,
they could bypass the selection process.
They could bypass the selection process, Jim. And what you'll have, though, is right now, as before, it's 5-4, it appears, for other candidates other than Mr. Smith, based upon that finalist top three vote.
Okay, so he may not be able to get to five. Can either of the other two get to five?
That's where, at least what I'm being told, and it's not being told outright, but one board member can abstain from voting. That would be four votes. You need a simple majority, they call it, which is five votes to pick the next superintendent. So, there may be some interesting drama.
But if
tonight.
One abstained, you'd still need five. You need two to abstain.
Well, you need
to get to four.
You need five votes to pick.
Oh, you're saying you have to get to five no matter who's there. I see what you're saying.
So they have that can be done. It can, in a sense, block the vote to to pick the man.
Well, there's a lot of drama, and we don't know how it's going to go, but it appears it's far from certain, as we're just a few hours away from the vote.
Correct. So, and I think that what you've seen, of course, the late word is that hundreds of people are going to show up. They may have to move that venue to another location to make that vote. The school department is weighing that right now, I'm told. Mm-hmm. So it's been an issue.
And right now it's slated to happen at the school board office, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
High drama, and thanks for coming in, John, and thanks for taking our town by storm. He's a good man, good reporter. See him at Louie's every now and then.
Yeah, first week here.
Yeah.
I was having breakfast, and who was sitting next to me was Jim.
There you go.
And
there you go.
Talk about a stroke of luck.
Well, thank you, my friend.
Keep going.
And we're joined now by Caroline Romer, who, as I said, knows a thing or two about Louisiana politics and intrigue. She is the eldest child, the only daughter of Charles Elson Buddy Romer, my good friend, who gave us 77 and a half great years, October 4, 1943 to May 17, 2021. You know, I think of him every day.
You know, I wondered if we would mention him today, and I knew we would, Jim. He loved you too, so it's good to be with you.
Well, he was a brilliant man, and what a raconteur. He was a guy who captivated the masses, shall we say, at the Joe Muggs Coffee Shop at Books A Million.
Yes, he was that anomaly for a long time in politics. He read books. He read seven different newspapers, and I miss him very much.
He was a speed reader, too.
Yes, he was.
Yes.
You know, when we share a common trait about each other, the acorn doesn't fall far from the tree, and people used to often say of him, often wrong, never in doubt.
That was what Tip O'Neill said, yeah. And he enjoyed that description. he was a confident man, shall we say.
He was.
And he graduated first in his class at 16, went off to Harvard at 16 years old. Not many people do that.
No. And, you know, since then, my brother Chaz went there. Now Chaz's son is there. So we have
a long
history.
And where did you go?
Let's not talk about my college years, Jim.
Did you go to Harvard as well?
Heck no.
I didn't think so.
Oh,
I didn't think so.
I'm
you were
an
the
LSU grad.
You were the rebel. You were
I'm
the
an
rebel.
LSU grad, yes.
And Dakota went to Boston U, right?
He was at Suffolk University in Boston. So Boston is near and dear to our hearts.
Yeah,
John.
Where John grew up. So, but Caroline's been involved in charter schools now for a while.
A while. It'll be 17 years that I've been in this job this fall.
And there is, of course, always discussion about whether they're a good thing, a bad thing, or somewhere in between.
It's always a very contentious conversation.
And you've been a fair person to talk about this on our show, because you acknowledge that there are people who have another point of view.
Absolutely. I sit here and say, I don't believe charter schools are the silver bullet that will cure everything, but I believe that we can be part of the public school system, give families choices, and balance that choice with accountability. And I deeply believe, as do our members, that, you know, it's not just about getting kids in the building, it's getting outcomes for those students. And when you can't do that well, maybe you should go find another job.
How many charter schools are there, public charter schools, in your association?
Statewide, there's 147 charter schools serving about 94,000 students. We're happy to be here today talking with you. In this coming year, we'll be celebrating 30 years of Louisiana charter law that passed under Mike Foster. And so this past legislative session, we did a lot of good work with a majority of our legislators to modernize our charter law and, you know, to kind of put a stamp in place around what charters are and why they should be part of the education system in Louisiana.
And there were many machinations at the state legislature in the recent session, and some of them involved charter schools. And Governor Landry signed into law a series of bills. I suspect you were supportive of these.
Yes, we actually, as an association, we came with a package of bills. We had six total bills. Five of those we were able to get across the finish line and have the governor signed. And again, we think these are bills that both modernize our existing charter law as well as put into place some protections for charters around what it means to be a charter school.
One of them would ease enrollment requirements.
Yes.
How will that work?
So Barbara Freiberg carried a bill, probably our most controversial bill, Jim. Current charter law requires that a charter school have a demographic that is reflective of the traditional public school system in which that charter is located. So it's a quota on enrollment. So even though our law says that we are open enrollment, choice schools that cannot discriminate, it also then placed a quota on what we should look like inside the building. And so our bill attempted to remove that quota, but at the same time strengthen anti-discrimination laws and bring greater transparency to how our lotteries and enrollment work.
Hold tight. 877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number, and we'll return with Caroline Romer after this 89.3 second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, and we're spending some time with Caroline Romer, who for 17 years has been involved in charter schools in Louisiana. She just told us charter schools now serve 94,000 students in our state. And we're going over some legislation that passed that will change the terrain to some degree. But in your estimation, and a listener asked this, by the way, again, 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. This is Hal in Monroe saying, what is the, in your view, as a person who is on the front lines, what's the basic advantage of a charter school over another school?
We talked a bit about it a second ago. I think, one, empowering parents to make choices about what type of school they think meets the needs of their child. I think empowering teachers to make decisions as close to children and their classrooms as possible, but balanced with accountability, a focus on how are you doing on those things that we value the most, reading, writing, math, those sorts of things. And when you do it well, you get to continue to do the work. But with a charter, which is a contract, when you don't do it well, you don't get your contract renewed.
I have another listener. This is Tom on Bluebonnet asking about compensation. Is compensation for teachers at charter schools comparable or perhaps even more than it is for those who teach in public schools or less? How does that work?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. That's a great example of why we put a definition in the law in one of our bills this year that defines what autonomy means. And autonomy for a charter school includes control over their budget and setting things like compensation and the terms they have for their teachers. You know, you have to, a lot of people talk about charter schools are a choice for students. Well, it's also a choice for a teacher. No teacher is assigned to a charter school. So the charter school has to compete and they have to create things like compensation and benefits packages that are attractive to teachers to want to be there.
So you're saying it's generally at least as much?
Or? At least, I can't say like a broad brush. All I can say is, as a charter, you are competing for teachers to come into your building. And so if you are not offering them things that appeal to them, then you're going to have trouble staying open.
Stacy on Highland Road. Stacy, you're on Talk Louisiana with Caroline Romer.
Hi
Stacy.
Hi, Mr. Ebser, Ms. Romer. It's nice to talk to you. I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about how charters, being part of the public school system, serve children with disabilities. Because in our experience, it's kind of a discriminatory system against kids with disabilities because most schools don't have the resources to care for kids who can't make it in the public school system either.
Thank you for the question, Stacy. It's actually a good one and I think an important conversation that we have often. So as I stated, charter law says that a charter school as a public school is to be open enrollment and is to not discriminate against students, race, special needs, et cetera. And so we are required to serve students. But again, it's a choice of the parent to be there. No student is assigned. And when a charter is not doing that well, that is part of their accountability framework that their authorizer, in our case, that's either a local school board or the state board, can investigate and look into.
877-217-5757. There is still time to speak with Caroline Romer, the executive director of the Louisiana Public Charter School Association. Patrick in Innisfail Estates. Hello, Patrick.
Hey, so before Jim had you on, he was talking about the next school superintendent, which I think is an overpaid position and doesn't accomplish anything from the ones we've seen in the past, sir. What do you think? Do you think it really matters who we pick as school superintendent?
I do think it matters. I think it matters. We have two needs at that school district level. You need a board, an elected body that sets the vision and the priorities, mm-hmm. and then you need a leader that can follow through and implement on that strategy. And so I do think it matters. I agree with you. Unfortunately, oftentimes we see a revolving door of superintendents at the local level. And I'm hopeful that this board tonight will come together. I actually think while they may be of different race and different politics, I actually think they agree more than maybe they recognize on what they want. And so I hope that they'll come out tonight with a decision. They need to. This, I think it's one of the hardest jobs as far as superintendent roles in the state right now, between St. George, between this is a district that can't even get kids picked up regularly by their buses. They've got financial problems. Like, this board needs to come together and find someone that can lead.
How much influence does the superintendent have, if any, on charter schools in East Baton Rouge Parish?
A lot. Again, between the board and the superintendent. So let me back up. As I said, we refer to school boards and BSEE as our authorizer. They authorize a charter school to do the work. As the authorizer, they are responsible for setting the terms of the contract. So what are the expectations? So then the superintendent is then responsible for oversight to see that those standards are met.
One of the bills, Caroline, signed by Governor Landry would, quote, clarify charter schools have autonomy over curriculum and budgets. What does this mean in the real world?
Yeah, so again, I keep talking about choice, autonomy, and accountability. Autonomy, in our opinion, is very critical because what we believe to be one of the problems, I will limit it to public education, is too many mandates, too much micromanaging by the politicians instead of allowing educators to educate. So that autonomy allows a charter school to make decisions inside their building versus those decisions being made for them by the school board.
877-217-5757 is your number for Caroline Romer. We'll spend a bit more time with her. Paul in Opelousas. Paul, you're on the air with Caroline.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning. Good morning, Caroline. Just a synopsis. Do you think that after charter schools are established, let's just say 50% in Baton Rouge Parish, and you got the rest in public schools, will the public school system just be left with what's left over? Because if you open up a charter school today, everybody can't get in. That's the face. And every teacher can't get in.
Yeah, well,
so
how
what will leave? What would be left with the public school system? Thank you.
All right. Does it affect the public school system adversely to have charter schools that are thriving?
Thanks, Paul, for calling in. Again, a common conversation is that charter schools are taking away from the public school system or the traditional system. We feel very opposite of that. We believe we enhance the public school system by offering parents other options that are still public and open to all, free, open to all public schools. And I would also push a little bit and say that, you know, when you just leave an entity to exist with no form of competition, that's called a monopoly, and sometimes people don't do their best work as a monopoly. So I also believe that when you have options in place for families, public, private, homeschool, whatever that is, that's going to lift all boats and make everyone work a little harder and be a little more customer-centric.
You're sounding like your dad. A rising tide lifts all boats. I've heard that a time or two. Allowing state and federal agencies to become charter school partners. This is another bill. What does this one do?
Yeah, it already existed, Jim. So we have different types of charter schools, including one that often is referred to as a corporate charter. A corporate charter is a school in which a local company, business, industry has partnered with that charter school by investing in the school's infrastructure. And in return for that investment, the company gets opportunities to attend the school. They get seats in that school. So this bill changed it to allow the corporate partnership charter school to go directly to BSEE for approval versus having to go to the local school district first, if they choose to.
All right. And as we hit the break, another one would provide schools with additional time to renew their charters.
Yeah, we saw an issue. So charter law is very specific about the contract, how many years a charter can get. And we saw some issues after COVID that was so disruptive, and the authorizers were in a bind in having any flexibility around how to deal with those contracts.
877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Caroline Romer. Then it's Mark Ballard after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. On deck is Mark Ballard in the Beltway, the remarkable reporter for The Advocate and Picayune for many years, and there's much happening in our world as we are now getting closer and closer to November 5th. But we are right now focusing on schools for a few more moments with Caroline Romer, who is a proponent of charter schools. She's done this for 17 years. And your number, if you'd like to get it under the wire, is 877-217-5757. Now, I remember Chaz, and this is a listener asking whether your family's been an investor in charter schools. Chaz was. I don't know if you were, but...
So all charter schools have a nonprofit board that does their governance, just like an elected board would for a traditional system. And so Chaz has served on a charter board, as well as served on BSEE for a long time. The rest of my family have chosen a different path. We have chosen the policy path and have worked much more on the sidelines in the area.
So other than your job,
you're not
getting rich off charter schools or anything like that.
No, I'm not.
No. And Chaz, he did something your dad never did. He won an election without an opponent.
It's a miracle.
And there's a guy who could have been a congressman, could have potentially been a governor, but he chose to go another route. I think that's one of the problems in politics now, is that a lot of people who have the aptitude and the ability to win, they don't go there. They don't want any part of it. And after seeing what your father went through, I suspect I know why.
Yeah, and I think Chaz chose a path. He had two children still at home, and I think he wanted to be a dad, and frankly, Jim, he also wanted the opportunity to work with his dad and invest and build things and try to make Louisiana a better place through routes other than the politics.
And Chaz is now 54 years old, and to put it in perspective, your dad was 47 when he left office. Isn't that amazing?
He was a baby. I think that he would say, one, he was surprised when he caught the governor bus, and probably would say, maybe I needed a few more years of wisdom on me.
Hannah, near LSU. Hannah, you're on with Caroline. Please be brief. Hi, Hannah.
Hi. I wanted to bring up a study that I recently saw from Tulane University that, on the one hand, corroborates what your guest said about competition improving school scores. But that study also showed that the benefit sort of caps off or plateaus after 15% of total enrollment. So I guess I would like to hear her response for how many charters is too many, or when do you, based on this study, feel that the benefit stops being as beneficial?
It's a really good question. I often ask myself if we were... You know, in New Orleans, being an all-charter system, you are now the system of schools versus the interrupter, if you will, disruptor, whatever word you want to, the change maker. So I'm not sure that I ultimately believe, though, that that's what prevents schools from excelling, but it's a worthy debate and conversation.
How's the teacher-pupil ratio in charter schools?
It varies. Again, that would be an example of autonomy in a school having the ability to decide how they want to model their classrooms. We have some that are very small. We have some that are larger but have multiple teachers as a model in the classroom. So that varies, but a great example of making decisions inside a building and figuring out what works best for kids.
Last question for Caroline Romer, and then it's Mark Ballard, Phil, and Jefferson Terrace. Hello, Phil.
Hello, Ms. Romer. Listen, our when gun death is the biggest death of children lately, guns by death in our country.
All right. Well, that's an issue affecting all schools, and what kind of precautions can be taken to thwart a crazed gunman, and we've had more than a few, and of course they sometimes focus upon schools.
Yeah, it's a common, there are things shared between charter schools and traditional schools. We have many of the same challenges, finding teachers, keeping kids safe, mental health issues. So it's a common issue that we all would love to figure out and solve.
Should teachers be armed?
I'm going to say no. I'm not a fan of that. I think our schools should be a place that's safe inside for everyone, and that instead we need to focus on how to prevent folks that should not have guns getting in our schools.
All right. Thank you, Caroline. Good to see you, and keep going, and let's talk
Thanks
again
for having
soon.
Me,
it's been too long. Thank you. Thank you. We're joined now by our weekly visitor, Mark Ballard at The Advocate and Picayune, and he is in Washington, D.C., and the wheels are churning. Now there is an open revolt in some quarters to remove Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. Turns 82 on November 20th. Some believe he is past his prime and cannot defeat his 78-year-old challenger, the former president, Donald John Trump, the man from Gotham City who lives large, talks big, and right now feels like he is in a good position, and polls indicate that he is the definite front runner in this race. Mark, what do you hear about where we are and where we're going regarding November 5th, which is 16 weeks from Tuesday?
Well, I'm not really sure how open the revolt is. You do have people like George Clooney, who wrote and said that who's a major contributor to the Democratic Party, saying that he doesn't think that they'll win. There are a couple of senators and a few representatives who've said that they're going to. But I think what we're seeing now is a lot of kind of under the surface sort of tension. You're basically looking at about five people with whom the Biden administration is going to listen to, and that would include Nancy Pelosi. That would include who yesterday kind of raised this sort of specter of if he was to leave, you know, and that sort of thing, you know, raising that conversation. You're looking at Chuck Schumer, the Senate majority leader, and who is privately telling donors that he's not sure that Biden can win. And you're looking at former President Barack Obama in there. James Clyburn from South Carolina is also a member of all of that. And their statements have not been all-out support lately. We're going to see today how well he's doing. They're putting up this press conference involving NATO, which is at 5 p.m. my time, so 4 p.m. at home, as a test to see how well the president does on his feet in a free-wielding conversation and with lots of questions coming at him. So It's all still up in the air. It's all still up in the air, and we're going to see. So
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. And a listener, this is Mike in Is it Biloxi? Yeah. He says this conversation should not be about whether Biden is capable, but whether he's electable. And right now, as I look at the tote board in Las Vegas, Trump is a 58% choice to win the presidency. Number two is Kamala Harris at 16%, and number three is Joe Biden at 14%. And that's a shocking number for an incumbent president 16 weeks from an election. And the one that I look at most closely, because it is the Electoral College, the overall vote means very little, if anything, because Hillary Clinton won the overall vote by 3 million votes. Albert Gore won the overall vote by about a million votes, and they both lost elections in the Electoral College. But Biden has to carry Pennsylvania, and it is a neighboring state. It's all but his home state. He calls himself the man from Scranton. He's down 5.3 points in Pennsylvania. And if he can't carry Pennsylvania, he loses the election. So ultimately, will the numbers drive him out rather than any speculation about whether he is going to fall apart in the next 4 years, Mark?
Well, I mean, I think that the numbers are going to be the deciding factor, but they're not going to say because we're going to lose. They're going to say because he's discovered that he needs to spend more time looking at his health and working with his family. That's going to be the excuse that is given on it. But obviously the numbers are what's driving a lot of the politicos' thought processes here. But particularly if you're in a swing state and you're running for the House and Senate.
In every congressional seat, every U.S. Senate seat that is available this year, and there is enough to swing the balance, obviously, and not all 100 seats are up, but it happens, as we know, they're six-year terms, so usually they're about a third of them are up every 2 years. So here we are, with all these people who are Democrats, who many of whom are in tight races, and they know that elections are often won at the margins, and they fear that a weak candidate at the top of the ticket will drag them down. And I can tell you Mary Landrieu would not have been a U.S. senator if not for Bill Clinton. In 1996, Bill Clinton beat Bob Dole by almost a quarter of a million votes in Louisiana, and Mary Landrieu beat Woody Jenkins by 5,788 votes, which means there are well over 200,000 people who voted for Clinton and then voted for Woody Jenkins, which is really amazing. But, Mark, it does show that the person at the top of the ticket does have an impact on the rest of the ballot.
Yes, I mean, that's true, and that is what's worrying a lot of the senators and the entirety of the Democratic portion of the House. I mean, let's take a look at that. That this has kind of just ended the conversation about how dysfunctional the Republican majority has been in the U.S. House. I mean, with they call them the five families that can't seem to agree on the time of day, and basically threw out one speaker and threatened another.
We'll be back with Mark Ballard. Your number, 877-217-5757. More after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to Talk Louisiana, and your number is 877-217-5757. Please send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. And we're visiting with Mark Ballard, as we do most weeks, the man in the Beltway, covering politics for The Advocate. And he is discussing what's happening in the world at large. And right now, the world in Louisiana, we know Donald Trump is likely to win Louisiana, as Joe Biden is likely to win California and New York. But it's those swing states that are important and will determine who wins the 2024 election. And in every one of the so-called swing states, Donald Trump is ahead. Now, in Wisconsin and Michigan, it's real close. And some would say that if Biden can pull it together, he can win those states. But he is now down by 5.3 points in Pennsylvania, a state he has to have, most likely, to win the election. Today's Wall Street Journal, pressure on Biden keeps up as allies wobble. President Biden's push to shut down efforts by some Democrats to get him to abandon his reelection campaign sprang leaks yesterday as a party heavyweight indicated his candidacy remains an open question, and a megawatt Hollywood donor urged him to step aside. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says it's up to the president to decide if he's going to run. When asked if she supported Biden as the Democratic Party's nominee, effectively brushing aside his off-stated vow to stay in the race after a disastrous debate, "We're all encouraging him to make that decision because time is running short," she told MSNBC, while actor and filmmaker George Clooney said the 81-year-old Biden should quit the race to give Democrats a chance to defeat Donald Trump. Clooney, who co-hosted a major fundraiser, $28 million is what they raised for the president, said that Joe Biden should make way for a stronger candidate, noting that the Joe Biden he saw 3 weeks ago was not the Joe Biden he saw in 2010 or 2020. And he will be 82 years old, but his opponent's an old man too, who, as you can see, is not in the best of physical condition. But despite the fact that Donald Trump is nearly the same age as Joe Biden and has 34 felony counts against him, convictions on those counts, it is remarkable that he is now the solid favorite, Mark. Who would have thought this would be the situation we'd be looking at on July the 11th?
Yeah, politics is certainly interesting. I was thinking about that this morning. Is it could you have said this, that someone who's been convicted of 30-some-odd felonies and who's been accused of trying to overthrow an election would be likely the next president? I mean, that just, it's remarkable. But it's politics.
And also found liable in a court for sexually assaulting a woman in a department store in a dressing room, a woman he said he did not know, just as he's basically said about Stormy Daniels, and there's photographic evidence that he knew both of them. He also said E. Jean Carroll wasn't his type, and when he was shown a picture of her at the time the assault allegedly occurred, he thought it was Marla Maples, his wife, who obviously was his type. So Donald Trump he's resilient, if nothing else, and right now I can only imagine if he won, and what if he won in a huge way? What if he carried 30 states, Mark? I would imagine he would govern as though he had, quote, a mandate.
Well, I think we've seen a lot of that in Louisiana right now, as the route that he is going to take. I guess I'm more of a glasses half full sort of guy. I don't think that there's going to be, you know, the end of democracy as we know it, the end of the republic as we know it. But there will be a significant shift to the right if he wins, and particularly if he went at some of the handicappers are saying now that if the House and Senate go Republican, you're going to see a significant shift to the right. Want to point out, though, that, you know, it's only July 11th and the election is in November, and a lot of things could change just as they have changed for President Trump.
Next week, the Republicans meet. Trump has not even selected his running mate. And this is not unprecedented. George Bush chose Dan Quayle as his running mate in 1988 in New Orleans at the convention. So who does Trump choose? Does he go safe? Yesterday, Scott Wilfong, the Republican consultant, said on our show that he thought he would choose the governor of North Dakota, Doug Burgum. But I don't know. Trump is not likely to choose somebody who is flashy, because, as Manuel Martinez says, you can only have one peacock in a relationship, Mark.
Yeah, most of the talk up here is for him to be looking at has kind of narrowed it down to three finalists. Of course, you know, we're talking about an imperious candidate who, you know, changes. But the three candidates that apparently have gotten the most look by the Trump team is Marco Rubio from Florida, the senator from Florida, J.D. Vance, the senator from Ohio, and Oh, I can't.
Burgum
from right for the governor from South Dakota, and those are the three
North Dakota, of which
it looks like that J.D. Vance and Burgum are the kind of leading figures on that, primarily because Marco Rubio and Trump are both Florida residents, and there would have to be some sort of shifting around for them to both be on the ticket at the same time.
Well, Burgum is 67 years old, and he's been married a couple of times. He is a billionaire. He sold his company in 2001 for $1.1 billion. He's among the wealthiest governors he was in the United States. So he is he's a man of immense wealth, and he would be, it would seem, the kind of guy Donald Trump would gravitate to. But he's from North Dakota, which has a total of three electoral votes. Three. By the way, Louisiana has approximately the same population as North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Idaho, and Rhode Island put together. 5 million people, right? That's what those five states have. And yet they have 15 electoral votes, five times three, I believe, 15. Idaho might have four, so that'd be 16. And Louisiana has eight. So we're getting shortchanged, Mark. We're getting shortchanged.
Well, I'm going to keep pointing this out. I mean, it seems we do this a lot, but the founding fathers set this up as a political way to keep the small states having as big a voice as the bigger states, so that New York and now California, but at the time Virginia, would not, and Pennsylvania would not be choosing the president. And that's why we have an electoral college, so that the smaller states can have a voice of which we can complain about.
Mm-hmm. Now, a listener says, why isn't Jeff Landry on the short list for vice president? It would seem he would check all the boxes, and he's been highly loyal to President Trump. Why haven't we heard more, if any, about him as a prospect?
Well, President Trump has not really given me any information on that, but they're looking at the candidates that they were looking at, and he was not on even the winnow list, you know, that included at least Stefanik and Tim Scott and that sort of thing. So I don't know.
But he could be chosen, or he could be asked to be in the cabinet. And what happens if he's asked to be attorney general or some other position? That would seem to be the most likely one. Would he take that, or would some would say it'd be crazy to give up the governorship of Louisiana? But Jeff Sessions gave up a comfortable Senate seat in Alabama, became his attorney general, Trump, first time around. That didn't work out real well, Mark.
Well, I think, you know, being a senator from Alabama and being the governor of Louisiana are two different power. And I think that without a doubt that being governor of Louisiana carries more power with it than being governor of almost any other state. And you know, but whether Jeff Landry does that or not, it's really kind of up to him and his calculus as to what's the best path to move forward, if indeed he wants to move up.
Another listener, this is Holly in the Garden District, asked why wasn't Nikki Haley considered for the vice presidency. Well, Trump doesn't like it when people rough him up, and she roughed him up. She did work for him. She was ambassador to the UN, but she's not even invited to the convention. She will not be in Milwaukee. She has released her delegates, but she says she's not going to a convention in which she is not invited.
Well, and I think that Trump could have, kissed and made up on this, but the attacks are too soon. You know, basically you're looking at it several months ago. They were calling each other the vilest of names. And now, you know, 2 months later, you go, oh, never mind. And that apparently is a little too much. even in this political world, it was a little too much to overcome.
And as we part, Mark did a story, and I'm glad he did, about three young people from Louisiana who have their artwork displayed at the Capitol. One of them is Hannah Bradley, the daughter of John Ed and Kimberly Bradley of Mandeville, the guy who wrote It Never Rains in Tiger Stadium. This is quite an honor, isn't it, Mark?
Well, it is. I mean, there were literally hundreds of submissions that came across to each of the congressmen in the six districts, House districts in Louisiana, as well as across the country. They hang these artworks up in a tunnel that goes, that connects House offices and the U.S. Capitol.
Well, thank you, Mark Ballard. We'll call next week. And until tomorrow, stay safe and stay tuned.